Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 2nd of August. David K. Johnston joins us today to talk about the debt ceiling and the debate in Washington over whether to voluntarily default on the U.S. government's obligations. He says in a piece in Reuters, he is now columnist for Reuters, this was released a couple hours ago, that the U.S. government's obligations, this decision whether to voluntarily default, revealed a serious political ailment in Congress, and he calls it mass economic amnesia. 11 years ago, Republicans insisted budget surpluses were bad for the economy, while Democrats told us surpluses would make the economy flourish. Al Gore said pay off the federal debt. George W. Bush said cut taxes so people would have more money. During the Bush years, Democrats decried the red ink budgets, while Republicans assured us that no real harm would come from a $5 trillion borrow and spend spree. Yet last weekend, it was the other way around. The Democrats described a few more years of deficit spending as vital to making up for massive loss of jobs, while Republicans warned us that any more red ink would destroy America as we know it. Feeling confused? You should be. And maybe, like the Beijing government, you see the checks and balances the framers of the U.S. Constitution put in place to provide sound government replaced by farce. David K. Johnston joins us by phone today from Singapore, where he is on assignment for Reuters. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He's a lecturer at Syracuse University College of Law and Whitman School of Management. And he is the author of Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. We've been getting a lot of phone calls on this issue, and I'm sure there will be many this morning. Here's our phone number. Keep it in mind as soon as you'd like to call in. That would be fine. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hello, David.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi. What are you doing in Singapore, sir?
Oh, I'm this new job that I have is a worldwide assignment.
Oh.
I'm out covering the world and as it applies to taxes and accounting and public finance.
Well, that's a rather big job, David.
It's an absolute dream job, and I'm thrilled to have it.
Oh, congratulations to you. That's great. That's wonderful. All right, here we go. Let's talk about what's been going on. It seems like forever at this point in time. You say that in today's column that both political parties are have contributed to our federal debt, and what we have here is a manufactured crisis like the debt ceiling vote masking the real issue. What's the real issue, and how was this manufactured?
Well, the manufactured part is that we've raised this debt ceiling 78 times. We've only had a debt ceiling law since World War I. Most countries don't have one. And I don't think there's any reason to have one. This was not at all necessary. When, regardless of who was in the White House, the debt ceiling has routinely been raised. This was done for other purposes. And the underlying problem is that we have a tax system in the United States that is completely out of whack with the economic reality. It is slowly making us poorer. And instead of doing the very hard work of developing a new modern tax system like they have in Singapore and some other places, we have a Congress that is busy responding to rent seekers, campaign contributors who are seeking this favor and that favor and are using the tax system to redistribute income. And just let me give you one really good example of this. Directly south of you in Illinois, I reported in my column a week ago that six large employers, Ford, Chrysler, Mitsubishi, Navistar, they make International Harvester trucks, Continental, the German tire maker, and Motorola, the cell phone company, get to keep the Illinois state income taxes withheld from their workers' paychecks.
Hmm.
They are, in effect, taxing their employees.
And what was the reason for that, David?
Because they threaten to leave the state.
I see.
And so to keep them there, since they pay little or no state income tax, the easiest way to funnel money to them without writing a check was to say you can get a tax credit that effectively allows you to keep for the next 10 years, permanently keep, the income taxes withheld from your workers' paychecks.
Oh, my.
And I have now found another state that has this, and I am going through the laborious process of looking at all 50 states' statutes, trying to find others, because if Illinois has it and one other state has it, I suspect that there are others, and they've just never been reported on.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, the other side would say, well, if they leave, there goes the complete economy of the state of Illinois.
Absolutely. On the other hand, it also means that companies that don't get this deal are disadvantaged in the marketplace. And it also means that everybody else has to pay higher taxes or get fewer government services to make up for what these companies are getting. In other words, it is not a level playing field. And the Illinois law now encourages companies to threaten to leave, because there's this law that says, that was adopted in May, if you threaten to leave and can make a credible case that you could leave, gee, that sounds a real hard case to make,
right?
Then we will make a deal with you.
And isn't that happening everywhere? It's certainly happening in Wisconsin. People saying, well, we have to help businesses because we can't have them leave.
Yes, and what that tells you is that we really do not live in a society, as we're all brought up to believe, that's a market economy. That we are rapidly moving into what I call corporate socialism, in which we privatize gains and socialize losses, and increasingly, and I've now identified several different mechanisms that do this, taxes that people are forced to pay by law are going, it's a minority of taxes to be sure, but a growing billions and billions of dollars in taxes people pay are going for private gain rather than public purposes.
Why is it? Tell me what you think happened with this whole debt ceiling deal. How is it that the deal does not raise taxes on America's wealthiest, who all indications are taking home much more of the total income and wealth? They already have tax rates lower than they've been in years and years and years. Why didn't this deal deal with that and deal with what you just said?
Well, because we have a small, very vocal, and very adept at marketing and advertising, what I call ideological marketing, group in Congress and supporting them, who have managed to frame the issues in ways that benefit those people who are at the very top. The fact is that right now the federal government is collecting less than 15% of the economy in taxes. The historic average has been about 19%. We're in a, what I've said on your show before, is going to be a very prolonged doldrums, because we have to work through all these excesses that occurred during the decade just ended. And the public feels heavily taxed and doesn't understand that people above are relatively lightly taxed, for with good reason. In America, if you're a single worker who makes $26,000 a year, you give a third more of your income to the federal government than people who make $1 million a day. If you're a single worker and make $81,000, your income taxes alone are equal to the income taxes paid by, as a percentage of your income, paid by people who make $1 million a day. And in addition,
whoa,
many, many people at the top legally live tax-free and do not have to pay any taxes at all legally, or, in the case of people like hedge fund managers, they pay their taxes 10, 20, 30, 50 years from now if the IRS happens to know they actually owe them in that distant future.
And yet most Americans, the recent polls have shown, David, that Americans do believe there is an issue of fairness here, and they do believe that taxes on those very, very wealthy should be higher.
Yes, the polls, depending on how the question is asked, show that between two-thirds and 80% of Americans believe that those at the top should pay higher taxes. Some people respond to this with incomes as low as $250,000 for a married couple, others at over $1 million. But without a question, the public support favors some higher taxes. And the argument being made by those people opposing this, that these are the job creators and they won't create jobs,
right,
is nonsense. Right now, American corporations are sitting on $2 trillion of cash. It is earning interest below the rate of inflation. Well, you know, if you leave lettuce in your refrigerator, it eventually rots. If you leave cash sitting in a safe deposit box or a bank, it eventually rots. Companies are not investing for a very simple reason, and I say this as the chairman of the board of a little company as well as my other jobs, with 25 workers at the peak of the year. We hire more workers when we have more customers who have money to spend. No customers, fewer workers.
It's a catch-22 here.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely. But the real underlying problem of all this, Kathleen, is this. The American tax system is a very well-defined, effective system for the economy of the 20th century. We don't live in that world anymore. We had a national industrial wage economy. We had big factories with fixed plant and equipment that we could tax. We did not have the quote-unquote free trade rules we have now, under which we really have a labor arbitrage. Employers have fired American workers in Wisconsin and elsewhere who were costing them on an all-in cost basis $40 an hour and replaced them with people in China who on an all-in cost basis, including shipping the goods back to America, are costing them $1 or $2 an hour. And China and Korea are, you know, Korea in particular, they're sending us all these Hyundai and Kia automobiles. Try to find an American car in Korea, virtually non-existent. So all of these rules that we have are damaging our economy. They are benefiting one group of people who are making out like bandits, the financier class. We need to have a financier class. It's not an attack on having one, but we don't have balanced rules. And the tax system we need to have is one that recognizes that we've decided to have a global economy, that the most valuable assets we manufacture in America are two things that can be moved out of the country in an instant: molecules, as in the drug business, and numbers, as in algorithms, software, digital products. And in fact, companies generally, when they invent these things, they put the ownership of them in a company in a tax-free jurisdiction. Every time somebody buys a Viagra tablet in the U.S., and they're now about $18 each, and the manufacture of them costs pennies, a royalty payment is made by Pfizer America to Pfizer in the tax-free entity it has in Europe, and it becomes an expense in the U.S. that lowers the company's taxes.
Oh my goodness.
And you and I have to make up for that either with more borrowing or higher taxes or fewer government services.
People should just stop using Viagra.
Not much chance of that.
No, I don't think that's going to happen. Tell me, David, what this debt ceiling deal does. I'm worried about people who don't have jobs. I'm worried about people being laid off in larger numbers because of huge spending cuts. And what's that going to do to the whole economy?
Well, you know, this comparison that a lot of members of the Tea Party in particular have been making to households is the wrong comparison, and evidently none of them took anything beyond maybe Economics 101, or they would understand this. When demand falls, the government can make up for that and provide a stabilizer. And indeed, one of the reasons we're not in the Great Depression redo that we had in the 1930s, troubled as we are, is that we have unemployment benefits, but they're running out for many people, and they don't have jobs. We have disability. We didn't have Social Security disability back then. And the evidence, and there's lots of scholarly evidence on this, shows overwhelmingly that many people who are disabled continue to work until either they're unable to work physically or the economy turns down, they get pushed out the door, then they go apply for disability. And there's been a huge surge in people qualifying for Social Security disability. That adds to spending on the other side. And so in the short run, if we had followed the Clinton plan in 2001, and we had, even if we didn't have the surpluses, we would not have had these enormous increases in debt. We doubled the debt during the eight Bush years. President Bush incurred more debt than every administration before him. President Obama came into office with a $1.2 trillion deficit, and he's got a plan to whittle it down, but then we decided not to let the temporary Bush tax cuts expire, and not certainly for people at the top, And so the deficit is not going down as fast as it would. The president also has decided to, you know, push more deeply the war in the undeclared war in Afghanistan. Some would argue the secret war in Pakistan, and of course the conflict in Libya, and that's adding to our costs. The federal payroll is actually smaller than it was. It's been shrinking for a long time, but Congress for a long time has been approving these deals where we replace federal civil servants with private contractors, and Professor Paul Light at NYU has shown what the data reveals is that private contractor employees on average cost $2 for every dollar that it costs to have a civil servant. So that's another redistribution. And by the way, companies then have money to make campaign contributions to get more private contractors, which cost more tax dollars, which contribute to the deficit. Because a lot of businesses get rich off the tax system.
What about the president, David? Are you feeling that he was just ineffective in this whole debate? He has a lot of people upset with him.
He has a lot of people upset with him on both sides. You know, President Obama has always struck me as a basically a centrist Democrat who has a social conscience, but he has identified throughout his career very closely with the financial community. You know, he used to speak during his brief period in the U.S. Senate often at the American Enterprise Institute, which is a think tank that represents the interests of big business. And, you know, in his White House, the best of my knowledge, the only person on the White House professional staff who is not white is Valerie Jarrett. That's it. There were two. Now there's one person. But his office is filled with people who came from Wall Street, from hedge funds, from the financial community, from large corporations. And, you know, we had this announcement of a jobs program where Jeff Immelt and Ursula Burns, who's the head of Xerox, and some other people were there. And I think it was a day or two after that event that I was reading my hometown newspaper in Rochester, New York, and here's Ursula Burns' company announcing that they're going to lay off thousands of people. Mm. I think that the president is so intent in his belief in compromise and being a post-partisan president that the virulently partisan people who believe the Grover Norquist line that bipartisanship is date rape, have been quite successful in maneuvering him. That doesn't mean he hasn't had a lot of successes. He has, but he does seem to be too quick to acquiesce with people who are not interested in compromising. And his fundamental mistake here, by the way, was very simple. When he agreed back in December to extend the Bush tax cuts, he should have said, fine, but you have to extend the debt ceiling with enough money until after the 2012 elections, so that whether there's a new person in the White House or a new Congress, we can debate this with a clean slate. That was a major tactical error by somebody who is, at least on a political level, written up a lot as a very smart guy.
Yeah. David K. Johnson, our guest this hour. We have all our phone lines going, so we're going to start taking calls momentarily. He is now a columnist for Reuters, where his assignment, his dream job, as he says, is to look at really the world's economy. He joins us by phone today from Singapore, where he is on assignment. He's a lecturer at Syracuse University College of Law, Whitman School of Management, author of Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. We love having him as a guest because he always gives us new and rather startling information. I would recommend that you go to his column today, which does look at the issue of the debt ceiling and asks us to remember just 11 years ago that we're suffering from mass economic amnesia. Here's our number. Keep it in mind so you can get through eventually. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour number two of our program, The Horrendous Famine in Africa. We'll have two guests with us. Jonna Hamilton, who's an Oxfam aid worker currently working in the Dadaab refugee camp in northern Kenya, and we'll be speaking with the project director of the Horn of Africa Project International Crisis Group. David K. Johnson, this hour, here we go with your phone calls. Tom in Sobiski is our first caller. Hi, Tom.
Hi, good morning. is what I was really disappointed in is when President Obama did propose budget cuts of up to $4 million, get rid of the business tax cuts or credits, get rid of a lot of write-offs and everything, maybe even a little Social Security upping the age. And he didn't push it. I was very, very disappointed. And I'm writing him right now that I'm telling him I'm independent. I'm no longer a Democrat because I'm very upset with him. They should cut everything across the board for all businesses and then put tariffs on any country that supports their businesses through subsidies or tax credits and compete on a fair market.
David.
Well, you know, generally across the board cuts are not a particularly good idea. They don't tend to produce good results. But without question, there are all sorts of favors in the tax code. The reason the tax code, you keep hearing, you know, oh, the tax code is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. The tax form isn't much bigger. It's because of favors for people who are campaign contributors. And we certainly should really go after those. And some of the things that the president wants to go after, well, they're not big dollars, like the rules that let executives fly in corporate jets virtually free. They certainly ought to be gone after on the grounds of creating a level playing field and a competitive market. And Obama clearly is somebody who he'd rather switch than fight, or cave than fight.
Thanks very much for the call. I want to ask you a little bit more about the spending cuts, which seem rather undefined. I guess we'll hear more about them as the days proceed. What will be the effect of spending cuts? Where do you think they are, David? And what will be their effect on either slowing or growing the economy?
Well, we know that, I mean, I have not read this bill yet, and I actually read these bills because I've been reporting today, but we know that one of the things they've agreed to is to raise the age of Medicare to 67. There are health economists who argue that's actually going to raise costs because people who don't have health care will be longer till they get to it, and chronic illnesses that might have been treatable will get worse and will cost us more. I suppose on the other side, as with smokers, they may die earlier, and that'll save money for Social Security, although that's an awful way, I think, to think about these things. We're not extending unemployment benefits, so one of the problems we're going to have is that there are still 15 million people out of work and 15 million people working less than full-time, want to work full-time, and we're not having wage growth. And this bill will make that worse. It will lead to some additional layoffs, undoubtedly, of state-level employees. And you know, the airline ticket tax, which is a 10% add-on to your ticket, has expired. And it looks like Congress may adjourn without restoring it. And as a result, everything the FAA does except air traffic control has been stopped. I'm sorry. I'm somebody who flies an airplane 100 times a year. That's a very scary prospect. And it is not responsible public finance.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call, Tom. Here's an email from Rick in Madison. The Republicans seem to think any government spending is a drain on the economy. Perhaps your guest should explain to them why Joe, who works for BP Oil and buys food from Farmer John with his paycheck, is different from Mary, who works for the National Park System and uses her paycheck to buy food from Farmer John. Farmer John can spend the money from both to stimulate the economy.
Well, and of course, BP and Farmer John get massive indirect payments from the government. And my favorite little example here is pipeline companies. They get to embed in the rates they charge the corporate income tax, even though as partnerships they don't pay the corporate income tax. And for every dollar of profit they would have earned as a corporation net at the end of the day for the owners now get $1.75. It's not a lot of money to you individually, but if you can get a penny a day from every person in America through a tax subsidy, you get $1.3 billion at the end of the year. And there are lots of these things out there. And there isn't any difference between Joe the cop and Joe the BP worker or Joe the farmhand in terms of the taxes they pay on their incomes. So we certainly need to recognize that. We also need to recognize, Kathleen, that, you know, without a civilized society, there is no private wealth.
In the jungle, there's no private wealth except to thugs. And we need to respect and honor that civilization, commonwealth, is the basis of all private wealth. And if we allow the foundation of our economy to crumble, the superstructures are going to come down.
Andy in Lake Geneva, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Well, I kind of think that everybody's proverbially fiddling while Rome burns here. All this discussion about the rich and the taxes and so on. The simple fact of the matter is that America is hollowed out. Its manufacturing has left. The manufacturing has gone from 40% to 10%. It's gone overseas. We moved our operations overseas 25 years ago. Why in the textile area? Because there was no way to fundamentally compete with what was going on overseas. And so and now services have moved dramatically overseas. The reality of the United States is it's in a catch-22. And as this very smart hedge fund manager basically pointed out, who's made a lot of money for his clients over many years, we're going to have to dramatically debase our currency. We're going to have to become like China of old. Okay, we're going to have to be the cheap, low-cost exporting producer to start bringing this wave back in. But the reality is it's going to make us significantly poorer in the interim. And the offset to all of this is basically $14 trillion of taxes, of debt, and the government being 25% of the GDP and so on. That's what's going on. It's really actually not confusing. It's somewhat basic.
All right, let's get a response, Stephen.
Well, first of all, what the caller is upset about is exactly what I started off by saying. We have a tax system that is slowly making us poorer. It is destroying our economy. But there are some other things he said that are not clear at all. There are other countries that have much heavier taxes than we do and whose economies are doing much better. The Germans are a good example. They are a high-tax country. They have retained their manufacturing. They are doing very well. There's a lot more to it than the simple rate of taxation. There are tariff rules, trade rules, internal government rules. There are rules on where capital flows. I mean, it's a very, very complicated subject. But I don't agree at all that we have to go to driving down wages. I think that down that road is not a good path to go. And it's one of the reasons I've come to Singapore, and I'll be writing columns you'll see in Reuters at Reuters.com over the next couple of weeks from the work I'm doing here in Singapore.
Somebody has recommended that we look at Germany. Are there other world economies that you think we ought to pay attention to serve as examples for us?
Sure. Well, you know, in the Nordic countries, and the only two countries in the world where taxes are more than half the total economy are Denmark and Sweden. The Danes, poll after poll, shows are the happiest people in the world. They have figured out how to create a system where they don't protect jobs, they protect their economy. So if you're in an industry where the shift, whether it's technological or something else, happens, the government will provide you with 90% of your pay. They'll retrain you, whether you need a PhD course or 6 weeks of training. And then if you don't take a job they set up for you or find your own, you lose 90% of your benefits, which creates a powerful incentive for people to, you know, study hard and get a real job to go somewhere. And that's actually turned out to be a very successful system. The Germans have a system where labor is deeply involved in the companies, has seats on the boards. They don't have the majority, but they have seats on the boards. And as a result, the companies are encouraged to do things like make smart capital investments. And I'll show you a real good example of that. Federal Express is a non-union company. UPS is a union company. When you look at the data, you can see that one of these companies, UPS, is much more profitable compared to every unit of sales, compared to every employee it has, because it makes much smarter use of capital. It also has a higher density of business than FedEx, which affects this, but it makes smart use of capital. And we need to have rules that instead of saying, well, take your money out of the U.S. and go over offshore and take advantage of cheap labor, make it profitable to reinvest here in the United States.
So is your next assignment, well, if not, you should ask writers to send you to Denmark to study happiness.
Oh, I'm going to be doing stuff all over the world. I don't think I'll be doing happiness, but tax different ways that countries, you know, organize their public finance and the results that they get.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we have this idea in America that if
you can't do that. That was a German idea. It's terrible. Who cares what the Germans think? Who cares what the Canadians do? Well, you know, we don't have a monopoly on smarts.
Right. David K. Johnston, our guest, our phone number lines are finally open. If you'd like to get one, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Mr. I hope this, well, consider this more cloud than silver. Okay. I hope this isn't true from. Is supposed to be
Rich,
about,
Rich, I'm sorry. You're on a really bad phone line, so I'm going to ask you to give us a call back because we can't hear your words and we want to hear them. So thanks. Call us back, please. Ernest in Hayward. Hi, Ernest.
Hi. Your guest said that we need a new tax in the global economy. So why not tax that part of the globe or the earth within our own borders? It would be difficult to avoid a tax on the land and natural resources, and we'd simply be recovering the value of our common inheritance. Instead, we tax the economy, and that flees elsewhere, offshore or to China. After all, is not the worker worthy of his wage? But we seem to think otherwise. We seem to want to tax his earnings.
Well, you know, Ernest has raised a very, very interesting question. You know, in most of the world, oil, gold, minerals in the ground are the government's property. In the U.S., if it's private property on the surface, you own it underneath. And we are being ripped off on this. In the Gulf of Mexico, during the Clinton administration, contracts were signed for a lot of those oil wells out there in the Gulf. Only somebody forgot to include a clause that they had to pay royalties for this oil. We now know because of an investigation that, in fact, people from the oil industry were supplying some of the people at the Minerals Management Service with cocaine and were literally sleeping with them. And yet nothing's been done to correct this. And instead, what we've heard from Congress, particularly the Republicans in the House, is, well, a contract is a contract. We must honor this contract. I'm sorry, unconscionable contracts are broken by courts every single day of the week. And land is something that taxing land in a different way can be very useful. It can avoid sprawl. It can result in smarter development. It's one of the things I'm studying here in Singapore, where they have tremendously high land taxes. I'm going to be going to Hong Kong to look at their system also. But the caller raises some very good points. We have valuable resources we could be using to reduce our tax burdens, and instead we are using them to promote private wealth.
And thanks very much, Ernest, for the call. I want to talk a little bit about health care. You had some really provocative statements in today's column concerning this. One is you say that hospitals, you talk about the squeezing Medicare and Medicaid spending while making sure the richest among us enjoy lower tax rates than the middle class do. A result will be more luxuries at the top while pushing 40% of hospitals toward bankruptcy.
That's the position of the actuary for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, although let me want to point out that he says that'll occur in about 2050 when 40% of us, including me, will be dead. But, you know, one of the things we need to appreciate is that we do not pay Medicare and Medicare the full cost of coverage, and hospitals make this up by charging higher prices to uninsured people and to who have, you know, private coverage in one way or another and can pay their bills, and to people who have health insurance. And the Ryan plan, which said we'll save you $5 trillion over the next 75 years, net present value, the equivalent of $5 trillion today, by turning Medicare into a defined contribution program, what Ryan didn't tell you was, yes, but it will raise your other costs by $34 to $39 trillion. So for every dollar you would save in taxes, you would, out of your private pocket, spend $5 to $8. And our health care system is a complete disaster. If we could just solve the health care problem and get a modern health care system like every other major economy has, a lot of these problems would go away. And the number one issue in my mind that we ought to be pursuing is this. Small business owners like me, it's none of my business who my employees love, what religion they are, what car they drive, what place they live in, but their health
is my business, and I don't want to be in the healthcare business. We need to get healthcare off the backs of small business, and it will lower costs. And if you doubt that, you know, in Ontario, they're now building more vehicles than in Michigan, because in Ontario, healthcare is spread across the whole tax base. It's not put on the individual car companies.
They're building more vehicles in Ontario.
Yeah, they're right on the cusp of surpassing Michigan.
Really?
I think they have already done it. China has already surpassed us as the number one manufacturing country in the world. And going to the point that one of the callers made earlier. And that's because in Michigan, healthcare adds well north of $1,000. I think it's around $1,600 to each vehicle produced. It doesn't add a penny to the cost of vehicles produced in Ontario, as it appears on the books of the companies, because it's government-financed healthcare.
Right.
Single-payer government-financed healthcare.
We have Rich now from Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Hi.
There we go. Now we can hear you.
Okay. Could be good or bad.
It'll be good.
The issue I've been trying to follow involves the Mortgage Electronic Registry Systems, or MERS. Gretchen Morgenson in the New York Times has been writing about the fact that in the second week in July, the state attorneys general and top executives of the banking industries met to determine whether or not there would be any further liability for their mortgage loan abuses. And she's indicating that the deal is basically going to be rigged. The reason this upsets me so greatly is, in a consumer-driven economy, you don't want more money going back into the hands of the people who already have money. You want redress of grievances for the people who are just trying to make it day by day. And I hate to say it, but my conclusion is that this game is so rigged that I don't think the American people even pay attention or care much anymore to the idea that the people with the most power are trying to grab even more power, and the people with the most money are still not satisfied. They believe they deserve even more than they already have.
David.
Well, Rich has hit upon a really, really important public issue here, and people need to understand this. It's very important. Normally, when you buy a house, your mortgage gets recorded at the courthouse, and you can go down and trace the ownership of your property. You can find out the property taxes your neighbors are paying. You can find out who has a loan against it. If you're a contractor, you know, you want to know if there are liens against that property before you go and agree to do work on it. The bank set up this MERS system as a private, not public disclosed, mortgage recording system where you can't check the records. And one of the fundamental principles of business in the area of mortgages has to do with conflicts of interest. And what the MERS system has revealed is that people who had a financial interest in the mortgages are changing these documents, which is why people, some of whom never missed a payment, have had their homes foreclosed and taken away from them. This is a scandal of immense proportions. I would, by the way, heavily credit Kate Berry at the American Banker, who worked on this, as did some reporters in Palm Beach, Florida, long before Gretchen got onto it. Gretchen, being at the New York Times, as I used to be, of course, has this mass audience. But this problem is costing you money because they set this up primarily to avoid paying recording fees for titles. When the assessor's office, the county clerk's office doesn't get that money, you have to pay higher property taxes or get fewer other government services. And we now know without question that it is being used by people in the banking industry to escape the rules on fiduciary duty, on a duty of loyalty, to not act in their own interest against the interest of the customer. And trust me, folks, there are people out there who
had made every payment on their homes, who've had their homes foreclosed and taken away because of this system. It can happen to you. You should be calling your county authorities and saying, why aren't you joining litigation and demanding that every single mortgage be registered by these banks and prosecuting, seeking prosecution and jail time for every single person involved in these conflicts of interest because they violate a variety of both civil and criminal statutes.
Thank you, Rich, very much for your call. David K. Johnson is our guest this hour. He's joining us by phone from Singapore. He has, he's always had a big job, and now he has the world as his assignment. He is a columnist for Reuters, and you can find his work at Reuters.com. And his piece today is on the debt ceiling deal, the debt ceiling that he believes we have no reason really to have a debt ceiling. And always has interesting information that you just didn't know anything about, then you get a little bit upset about some of what he has to say. He is traveling the world, looking at the world's economy now for his new assignment. He is also a lecturer at the Syracuse University College of Law and Whitman School of Management, and we're welcoming phone calls for him. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email, we have quite a few of those, we'll get to them, is talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program, according to the UN, more than 12 million Africans are suffering from or are threatened by famine. We will have two guests with us, one of us joining us by phone from the Dadaab refugee camp in northern Kenya, and we'll also speak with the project director of the Horn of Africa Project for the International Crisis Group. David K. Johnston is here this hour. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Let's go to a couple of emails here. We've got some good ones. This one from somebody wants you, just remember these, David, to take on the elephant in the room, military spending, which is never mentioned. How important is it to our debt and to the economy to lower that number that we spend? Here's one from Dave in Menominee, Michigan, saying the president is dealing with Tea Party Republicans who are not in Congress in good faith. They're not there to help the country, but to try to damage the president. We don't know any of the facts about this deal, and yet the airwaves are full of how this president can't fight. I think the Republicans are playing checkers. The president is playing chess. It does no good for us, for this country, or for the administration to come out full barrel with criticism when we know so little about the agreement to begin with. Want to start with military spending?
Sure. Well, if you look at military spending, not the way the news media usually covers it, but by the accounting, it's much bigger than the Pentagon budget. In fact, it's double the Pentagon budget because the Pentagon is just one part of this. There's the CIA, the National Security Agency, which is vastly bigger than the CIA. There's the bomb-making division of the Energy Department. They do all the nuclear weapons work. There's Veterans Affairs, and this year the individual income tax will bring in a little over $1 trillion. I mean, we won't know till the end of the year, but much less, by the way, than it was bringing in the year 2001, a recession year when the Bush tax cuts first took effect. But it'll only bring in about $1 trillion. The total U.S. national security spending is about $1.5 trillion. This is a major drain on us. We are still maintaining tens of thousands of troops in Europe, which is plenty wealthy enough to afford its own security. We're still maintaining all those troops in Korea and elsewhere, and we are pursuing three, and some people would argue four, undeclared wars. And remember, the Constitution says only Congress has the power to declare war, something it hasn't done since December 9th, 1941. So we don't get a handle on military spending, we will have serious problems in our economic future. On the Tea Party people, you know, in my experience is that, well, there are some people who are
congenital liars and completely lacking in character. Most people operate from a sincere belief, and I think everybody I've interviewed connected with the Tea Party has been sincere in their beliefs. They may not be, in many cases, very well informed about what they believe, starting with what the Tea Party was about. It was not a protest against high taxes. It was a protest against a tax exemption to protect a failed monopoly and bail it out. Wonder where I've heard about that before. And it is absolutely true that the Tea Party people have been completely against the fundamental principle of politics, which is compromise. My way or the highway has been, for many of the Tea Party freshman congressmen, their position, and they're inspired in that by Grover Norquist, who, you know, famously observed that bipartisanship is political date rape.
Let's go to Mary Jane in Madison. Hi, Mary Jane.
Hello. I have a feeling that a lot of the problems we experience with our government can be laid directly on the people of this country. If we didn't have lifetime members of Congress, we wouldn't have the big problems we have with lobbying, with them always fundraising so they can win the next election. And the people have the power to change members of Congress on a regular basis. And I think that they have to pay more attention to what's going on and get rid of the people, maybe two terms, but then get them out of there so they aren't embedded.
David.
Mary Jane, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
What makes you think that having people with no real experience in running government, that is, people who only have two terms in office, that'd be 4 years to remember Congress, would better stand up to lobbyists who are there for their whole careers than career politicians who presumably have developed expertise?
I feel that they would not have the pressure of fundraising. As soon as they're sworn in, they start fundraising.
Okay, well, that's a different issue, and I agree with you that the fundraising is the key problem. I call that this the problem of the political donor class, and they have to start fundraising because of the rules we have, and that's the real underlying problem, is this dependence, and therefore what members of Congress, even if we went to your proposed idea, I don't think it would change this, they are going to hear mostly from lobbyists and representatives of corporations and well-to-do people about their problems, not about the problems of ordinary Americans. And if all you hear all day are about the problems of one aspect of the economy, guess what? Sooner or later, you're going to start thinking, well, these are the real problems.
Thanks, Mary Jane, for the call. Chris in Mount Zion. Hi.
What an honor to speak with you, Mr. Johnson, and thank you so much, Kathleen, for this show. I have two topics I'd like to cut. Just get to really quick. One is the prison industrial complex and the privatization of prisons. We seem to lock up more people than anywhere around the planet at a burden to our people and its tax base. The other one is the drug war. And use the marijuana as an example. 850,000 people arrested every year in this country for an innocuous substance, which there is no proof historically harms people, may actually prove to be beneficial to people, yet between big pharma, alcohol, and many others, they squash these efforts. And so we have a paranoid populace that doesn't understand these situations, and as a result, tell us about how this is hurting us and the taxes that may be benefited from a legalization.
All right, thanks.
Well, I think, Chris, that things on this front are changing. I mean, Arizona, one of the most conservative states in the country, has passed a medical marijuana law where it's legal to buy but not to sell, which creates a bit of a problem. But the suppression of drugs didn't work with alcohol. Drugs were not suppressed in this country before 1914. We didn't have a big problem with drugs before then. And I think the question is, where do you want to take your losses? If you legalize drugs, and hopefully we don't legalize them and then advertise them, then you will have some people you will have losses with because they make inappropriate use of drugs. Now you have all sorts of people being corrupted. And I think it is only a matter of time before the open warfare in the streets that you're seeing in some cities in Mexico, including Juarez right across the border from Texas, comes to the U.S. I think within 10 years, and maybe a lot less than that, we're going to all be riveted to our TV sets and watch an open gun battle in some city in the southwestern United States, Los Angeles, San Diego, Tucson, between police and drug dealers, because the profits are so huge, no amount of law enforcement is going to succeed in stopping them.
And thanks for the call. David, thank you so much. It's always a great pleasure to have you on. You just always have so many ideas. You just got all these ideas, things that we ought to know that we just don't know, and I appreciate you.
Well, thank you. I've been very privileged to have employers who've allowed me to do a lot of research and study to learn these things.
Yeah. Well, where do you go from Singapore?
I'm lecturing in China, teaching investigative reporting, and then I'm going to Macau and Hong Kong to write about their tax system.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, it is a dream job. Thanks, David.
Take care.
David K. Johnston joining us by phone from Singapore. He's on assignment. He is now a columnist for Reuters.com. You can find his columns at Reuters.com, and he teaches now all over the world, is lecturing at Syracuse University College, soon to go to China to teach, author of Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. And thank you for all of your calls and many, many emails. David always generates a lot of response. We couldn't get to all of you, but thank you.